making it clear that the sabbatical year is to the other 6 years what the Shabbat day is to the other 6 days. Humans are to sanctify the Sabbath. Animals are to rest on it. Verse 12 continued, "In order that your ox and your ass may rest, and that your bondman and the stranger may be refreshed." The Hebrew word vaynafash, refreshed, comes from the word nefesh, soul. The word used for the animals, your ox and your ass, ceasing from work, is the normal word for rest. But the word used for human beings, your bondman and the stranger, ceasing from work, can be rendered as ensouled. It is enough for animals to rest their bodies on Shabbat, but not enough for people. The fourth commandment is to make Shabbat holy, not just to rest. This law, the slave, bondman, the animals, and the stranger must all rest and have the Sabbath, is unique in ancient history, and perhaps unique in all history. All the laws from the conclusion of the Ten Commandments until this point have been ethical laws, laws governing the relationship between people. Therefore, this verse treats the Shabbat in that same vein, from an ethical perspective. We, our animals and servants, must rest. And since the Torah word for servant and slave is the same, slaves too had to be given a day of rest. At other points, the Torah's primary emphasis in discussing the Shabbat is on ritual, holiness, and affirming God as the Creator. Since the observance of the Sabbath is both an ethical and a ritual religious obligation, this verse serves as a bridge between the ethical laws preceding it and the ritual laws that now follow. Verse 13. "Be on guard concerning all that I have told you. Make no mention of the names of other gods. They shall not be heard on your lips." The prohibition on mentioning the names of other gods is reiterated because some Israelites might be tempted to invoke other gods in observing the festivals outlined in the next verses. Verse 14. "Three times a year you shall hold a festival for me." These three festivals were associated with important moments in the agricultural cycle: the planting, the first harvest, and the second harvest. Verse 15, "You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. Eating unleavened bread for 7 days as I have commanded you, at the set time in the month of Abib, for in it you went forth from Egypt." The feast of unleavened bread, matzo, is Passover, the holiday celebrated at the time of planting. In addition to its agricultural significance, Passover is most importantly the celebration of the Exodus. For that reason, it has become the most widely observed Jewish holiday, probably because freedom is a secular value as well as a religious one. As to how the Hebrew calendar was adjusted to make sure Passover was always observed in the spring, see the commentary on Exodus chapter 13, verse 4. Verse 15 continued, "And none shall appear before me empty-handed." God commands his people to appear before him in a sanctuary or other place of worship, bearing a ritual offering. See also Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 17. Verse 16, "And the feast of the harvest, of the first fruits of your work, of what you sow in the field." This is the holiday of Shavuot, the holiday that takes place at the time of the first harvest. Often referred to as Pentecost, Shavuot is the Hebrew word for weeks. This holiday of weeks was so named because the Torah commands it be celebrated exactly 7 weeks after the first day of Passover. In addition to its agricultural significance, Shavuot marks the Jewish people's receiving the Torah. Of the three festivals specified in these verses, Shavuot is the least widely observed today. One reason is it has the fewest rituals associated with it. Religion, and for that matter almost anything important, from patriotism to marriage, needs rituals. We are physical beings living in a physical universe. Physical expression, which is what ritual is, matters. And Passover and Sukkot, see next verse, are replete with rituals. The other reason Shavuot might be less widely observed is that moderns relate far more to the idea of freedom, Passover, than to a holiday celebrating the giving of the Torah. Verse 16 continued, "And the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the results of your work from the field." This is Sukkot, the holiday that takes place at the time of the second harvest. The Torah refers to this holiday as Chag Ha'asif, which comes from the Hebrew word for collect or gather in, and refers to the ingathering of the harvested crops. In addition to its agricultural significance, this holiday commemorates the temporary portable huts in which the Israelites lived while wandering in the desert. Sukkot means booths or huts, and the holiday is therefore known in English as tabernacles, the biblical term for a fixed or movable habitation, usually of light construction. Deuteronomy chapter 16 verse 15 commands us to have nothing but joy on this holiday, which is why later Judaism described Sukkot as the time of our happiness. As will be discussed there, happiness is a major moral and religious value. Verse 17. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the sovereign, the Lord. According to a basic principle in traditional Jewish law, women are exempt because of family responsibilities, the assumption being they are usually the primary caregivers to children, from all time-bound laws, such as this law to appear before God on the festivals. Women as well as men are bound by all negative commands, not to steal, not to slander, not to covet, etc., and by positive commandments that are not time-bound, such as love your neighbor as yourself and honor your father and mother. Having said that, women did indeed often accompany their husbands to the sanctuary, as reflected in the account of Elkanah, Hannah, and Peninnah, the story that opens the first book of Samuel. Verse 18. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened. This verse refers to the Paschal lamb sacrifice, which was offered each year on the anniversary of the eve of the Exodus. Paschal comes from the Hebrew word for the holiday of Passover, Pesach. Verse 18 continued, and the fat of my festal offering shall not be left lying until morning. According to Casuto, the purpose of legislating the sacred meal had to be eaten before morning was to prevent the riotous and unchaste behavior that might occur if a festival was celebrated all night. Verse 19, the choice first fruits of your soil you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. Essay. Why not boil a kid in its mother's milk? The meaning of an obscure law. Verse 19 continued, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Centuries ago, Maimonides speculated this prohibition was intended to keep the Israelites away from the idolatrous customs of other peoples. For some time, it was believed there was evidence for Maimonides' hypothesis. Ancient Ugaritic texts indicated the Canaanites used to prepare such a dish at festival ceremonies celebrating the fertility of the soil. However, in recent years, a major biblical scholar, Jacob Milgram, contended the ancient Ugaritic text was mistranslated, and there is therefore no evidence of the Ugarites engaging in such a practice. It would seem Milgram's knowledge of the Ugaritic text should prevail in this matter. I would, however, add this in defense of Maimonides' explanation. Solely from a common-sense viewpoint, it is difficult to imagine the Torah or any other body of law would prohibit a practice no one engaged in. And the Torah states this law 3 times. Here, Exodus chapter 34, verse 26, and Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21. If no one engaged in it, all the Israelites might well have shaken their heads, wondering what God or Moses was talking about. If some country's parliament prohibited stabbing fish while riding a bicycle, we would assume it was something people in that country did. However, even if it were proven that other nations did boil goats in their mother's milk, the question would remain, why would the Torah prohibit the practice, and on 3 separate occasions, no less? Clearly, the Torah is sending a message. It is wrong to boil an animal in the substance with which its mother gave it life. Obviously, the prohibition is not for the sake of either animal. Neither the mother nor the baby knows whose milk is being used. The purpose of the prohibition must therefore be to affect us, specifically to refine human character. We are never to forget animals are living creatures, and there is something mocking and even cruel about boiling a kid in the milk of its mother. This is not some modern explanation attempting to make the Torah look modern and moral. The first century Hellenistic Jewish philosopher, Philo, explained this law in exactly this way. He wrote, "It is grossly improper that the substance which fed the living animal should be used to season or flavor it after its death." And Milgram expanded on Philo's observation with an additional moral explanation. The root rationale behind the kid prohibition is its, the Torah's, opposition to commingling life and death. A substance that sustains the life of a creature, milk, should not be fused or confused with a process associated with its death, cooking. Mother's milk, the life-sustaining food for her kid, should never become associated with its death. It is not surprising that the ancient rabbis also did not look upon this law as pertaining only to baby goats. They regarded it as a moral teacher in the same way Philo and Milgram did, as another attempt of the Torah to teach a major distinction, the distinction between life and death. In part because Egypt's religion was death-oriented, the pyramids are tombs, its holy book was the Book of the Dead, etc., the Torah is replete with laws banning the commingling of life and death. One such law is this prohibition against boiling a baby goat, death, in its mother's milk, life. Another is the prohibition against a priest, who is to be preoccupied with life, from coming into contact with the dead, a law that is probably unique among religions. And another is the prohibition against engaging in sexual intercourse, life, while the woman is menstruating, the blood representing death, or at least the end of a possible new life. For this reason, though the verse only prohibits the boiling of a kid in its mother's milk, for as long as we know, Jews have not cooked or eaten milk and meat together. Verse 20. I am sending an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have made ready. According to Casuto, God is referring to himself, since he will guide the people through the desert. Of course, there is always the possibility God really will send an angel. Verse 21. Pay heed to him and obey him. Do not defy him, for he will not pardon your offenses, since my name is in him. It seems to me the least plausible explanation is the angel is God. For one thing, God is never elsewhere described as not pardoning, except in the third commandment, which prohibits the worst sin a person can engage in, doing evil in God's name. See commentary to Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. But whether referring to God or not, God is warning the people, the stakes are high. He is about to dispossess other nations so the Israelites can enter the land. And the Israelites' right to that land is not at all guaranteed. It is conditional upon their observance of God's laws. In the words of Leviticus, "Do not defile yourselves in any of these ways, for it is by such that the nations I am casting out before you defiled themselves. So let not the land spew you out for defiling it, as it spewed out the nations that came before you." Leviticus chapter 24, verses 18 and 28. Thus, if the Israelites do not behave appropriately, God will have dispossessed other nations unnecessarily. On the other hand, if the messenger is Moses, this verse is easier to understand. God is telling the people Moses, who was a human being and is therefore less compassionate than God, will not forgive the people if they disobey God's will. Verse 22. But if you obey him and do all that I say, I will be an enemy to your enemies and a foe to your foes. God's protection, the Israelites are told, is contingent upon their obedience. Unconditional acceptance, support, protection, none of these are Torah concepts. God's response to man, especially to the Israelites, is rooted in their acting decently. God does not fight on behalf of the Israelites per se, but on behalf of those who serve as conduits of his will. God's battle is moral, not ethnic. No one was annihilated. Verse 23. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I annihilate them. Given the moral problem God annihilating these nations appears to raise, 4 points are worth noting. First, annihilate does not mean kill every Amorite, Hittite, Perizzite, Canaanite, Hivite, and Jebusite. This is made clear 7 verses later in verse 30, where God says, "I will drive them out before you little by little." Furthermore, both the Bible later and modern archaeology affirm many Canaanites were not killed. See, for example, the report, "Fate of Ancient Canaanites Seen in DNA Analysis," they survived. Second, God is speaking about a one-time situation in which he will fight on behalf of the Israelites. There is no notion in the Torah of God promising to always do so. God makes no pledge to always fight against the Jews' enemies. Third, here it is God doing the fighting, just as in Egypt, where the Torah made clear the angel, not the Israelites, killed the Egyptian firstborn. Fourth, it has already been established God does not protect the Jews if they cease living by his laws. In ancient religions, the God's protection was nation-based, not morality-based. Jews who believe God would automatically fight on their behalf have not come up with helpful ideas. Indeed, they have sometimes been attracted to highly self-destructive ideas. For example, underground Jewish terrorists in Israel in the early 1980s plotted the destruction of the Dome of the Rock Mosque in Jerusalem, on the assumption that though it might trigger a worldwide Islamic jihad against Jews and Israel, God would intervene and Israel would win, leading to the building of the Third Temple on the Temple Mount, on which the mosque stands. The Torah's attitude toward idolatry in the land of Israel. Verse 24. "You shall not bow down to their gods in worship or follow their practices, but shall tear them down and smash their pillars to bits." The Torah is philosophically and theologically intolerant of idolatry. Rationally and morally, it could not be otherwise. The moment you assert there is only one God, and therefore only one universal moral standard, you are asserting the pagan gods are false. For those who believe tolerance is always a moral virtue, this may be disturbing, but one doesn't have to be an ancient Israelite or a modern monotheist. In fact, one can be an atheist to assert pagan gods aren't really gods. Moreover, it is morally inconceivable that tolerance is always a moral virtue. Are we to be tolerant of child sacrifice? The moral answer is self-evident. A number of other factors should be kept in mind. First, ethical monotheism's intolerance of false gods does not extend to persecution of followers of other religions. The follower of the Torah is neither instructed nor allowed to persecute, let alone kill, pagan believers because of their pagan beliefs. Second, even regarding pagan places of worship, this command applies only to the land of Israel. Jews were never called upon to destroy pagan places of worship outside of Israel. But in this one small land, ethical monotheism, the only solution to evil, is to be established so that from Zion shall go forth Torah and the word of God from Jerusalem. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3. At that time when ethical monotheism was new and very fragile, the presence of idolatrous places of worship would have made this impossible. Verse 25. "You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water." Do God's promises of no sickness conform to reality? Verse 25 continued, "And I will remove sickness from your midst." Verse 26. "No woman in your land shall miscarry or be barren. I will let you enjoy the full count of your days." God promises in return for serving him, he will eradicate illness, miscarriage, and barrenness. These verses are troublesome to our modern sensibilities, since righteousness has never guaranteed good health. Obviously, the God who split a sea, delivered water from rocks, and brought 10 plagues on Egypt can do anything. And if the Israelites all led the type of life God demanded of them, God might well have abolished illness. But as this has not happened, it is also possible these promises were made for the theologically primitive Israelites. They needed such promises to take God and ethical monotheism seriously. The Israelites, a group of ex-slaves who had lived among Egyptian idolaters for centuries, needed as clear a motivation as possible to fulfill the commandments. This is not to suggest in any way that God was bluffing. God was quite capable of removing sickness from Israelite life if they observed his laws. It is only to suggest no other promised reward would have been nearly as effective in getting the Israelites, or anyone else 3,000 years ago, to consistently do the right thing. Today, however, we are expected to understand that the reward for following God's will is not physical health. Though there is no doubt an ethical, God-centered life does have health benefits, but the act of obeying God. Jews understood this long ago. As the Talmud put it, the reward for observing a mitzvah, commandment, is not granted in this world. Rather, the Talmud says, the reward for observing a mitzvah is observing a mitzvah. No one can rationally believe doing God's will guarantees one will, for example, never develop cancer or die in an earthquake. If that were the case, we would have to draw the irrational and cruel conclusion that anyone who dies prematurely was being punished by God, or the equally irrational conclusion that all those who live long and healthy lives have lived God-centered lives. In more recent times, Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, the late president of Bar Ilan University, Israel's Orthodox University, maintained there is indeed a correlation between moral law and natural law. When people act decently, disease is minimized. For example, God wants people to treat the earth well, and when they don't, pollution of the environment leads to poor health conditions. God wants people to engage in monogamous sex, and non-monogamous sexual practices are the ones that cause sexually transmitted diseases, such as syphilis, genital herpes, and AIDS. So, too, those nations with the longest lifespans are free countries, not tyrannies. Take the dramatic example of North and South Korea. The identical nation and ethnic group divided into two countries, one free and one a tyranny. In 2012, the lifespan of Koreans in the free South was at least 12 years longer than that of North Koreans. Verse 27. I will send forth my terror before you, and I will throw into panic all the people among whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn tail before you. Verse 28, I will send a plague ahead of you, and it shall drive out before you the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites. Verse 29, I will not drive them out before you in a single year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply to your hurt. Verse 30, I will drive them out before you little by little. Even though the word annihilate was used in verse 23, it does not mean wipe out everyone living in Canaan. This verse makes it clear God does not intend to annihilate all the Canaanites, but they will be gradually removed from the land, owing to their terrible moral conduct. In the eyes of the Israelites, however, it will eventually appear as if those nations were annihilated. Verse 30 continued, until you have increased and possessed the land. Verse 31, I will set your borders from the Sea of Reeds to the Sea of Philistia, and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hands, and you will drive them out before you. The Torah is outlining here the ideal borders of the Jewish state, borders never fully achieved even during the time of Kings David and Solomon, when the Jewish state was at its largest. And while David and Solomon asserted political and economic hegemony as far north as the Euphrates, 1 Kings chapter 5, verse 1, they did not dispossess the local peoples and settle Israelites in their stead, Sarna. Moreover, it was not up to the Israelites, or Jews thereafter, to set these borders. It is for God to do in His time. I will set your borders. Verse 32. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. Verse 33. They shall not remain in your land, lest they cause you to sin against me, for you will serve their gods, and it will prove a snare to you. As noted above, the goal of the commands to drive out the Canaanites was to develop one small corner of the world in which ethical monotheism could grow. The Bible scholar Yeheskel Kaufman argued it was only because of these wars against Canaanite nations that Israel did not assimilate into the indigenous population. It provided Israel's new religious idea with an environment in which it could grow, free of the influence of a popular pagan culture. As it happens, many Canaanite nations and peoples survived. Judges chapter 1, verses 27 through 33, lists repeated cases in which the Israelites did not dispossess the Canaanites. And the biblical warning, it will prove a snare to you, turned out to be correct. Israel's later history is replete with accounts of the Israelites assimilating with pagan tribes and worshiping their idols. To cite one example, Judges chapter 2, verses 11 through 13, cites instances in which the Israelites forsook the God of their father, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and worshiped Baal and the gods of their neighbors. Chapter 24. Verse 1. Then he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord with Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu." The Hebrew word ale, come up or rise, appears several times in this chapter. The word often implies the act of arising to do something holy. It is used in its noun form, aliyah, in the Jewish prayer service to refer to a person going up to bless the Torah. The same word, aliyah, is also used to describe the act of going to live in Israel, literally, going up to Israel. Nadav and Avihu, mentioned at the end of the verse, are Aaron's two oldest sons, Numbers chapter 3, verse 2. The priesthood has not yet been established, but when it is, the Torah ordains it to be transmitted generation to generation from father to son, Exodus chapter 40, verses 12 through 15. To this day, Jews who know themselves to be priests, Kohanim, trace their ancestry in a direct line back to Aaron. The devaluing of the old means wisdom isn't valued. Verse 1 continued, "And 70 elders of Israel." Throughout history, not only in ancient Israel, virtually every society greatly valued old people, because old people were associated with wisdom, and wisdom was valued. In the contemporary world, especially in the West, youth is increasingly valued more than age. That is either a reflection of the fact that wisdom is less valued, and therefore the old are less valued, or the old are less valued, and therefore wisdom is less valued. It is hard to know which came first, the devaluing of the old or the devaluing of wisdom, but whichever caused the other, both are tragedies. In answer to some young people who told the great German Jewish actor Fritz Kortner he could not understand their problems, Kortner responded, "You were never as old as I am. On the other hand, I was as young as you are now." The devaluation of old people is a tragedy for their sake, for society's sake, and for the sake of the young who can so benefit from being with and learning from the old. Anyone who has or who has had a bond with a grandparent or a mentor knows how true this is. And the devaluation of wisdom is an even greater tragedy. We live in an age that values, or at least claims to value, knowledge. But knowledge without wisdom tells you nothing about how to lead your life. It is like owning a map but having no destination. If you don't know where you need to go, knowing exactly where you are is useless. Verse 1 continued, "And bow low from afar." Bowing low involves full prostration, with one's head touching the floor, denoting a sign of total obedience. Verse 2. "Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but the others shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him." The Torah makes a clear distinction between Moses and the others with him. Only Moses is allowed to come closer to God. This is consistent with the Torah's posthumous assessment of Moses' unique status. Never again did there arise in Israel a prophet like Moses, who the Lord singled out face to face. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10. Verse 3. "Moses went and repeated to the people all the commands of the Lord and all the rules." The commands refer to the Ten Commandments. Chapter 20, the bulk of the laws written in a similar concise style in chapter 22, verse 17 through chapter 23, verse 19. And all the rules likely refers to those outlined both earlier and in the following chapters. Verse 3 continued, "And all the people answered with one voice, saying, 'All the things that the Lord has commanded, we will do.'" The Israelites give public assent to all the commandments and laws, a rare moment of agreement and unity in Jewish life. Verse 4. "Moses then wrote down all the commands of the Lord. Early in the morning, he set up an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel." Moses was just instructed to go up to God, but the Torah now interrupts the story of his ascent for an interlude about a sacrificial offering. Verse 5. He designated some young men among the Israelites, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed bulls as offerings of well-being to the Lord. Since these sacrificial offerings take place before a priestly class was designated, no one tribe was directly responsible for preparing them. Moses therefore assigned this task to a group of young men who were strong enough to lift the heavy bulls. Most of the sacrifices described in the Torah were public acts of ritual slaughter preceding the eating of the flesh. Only the burnt offering, ole, was not eaten. Rather, it was burned in its entirety. Verse 6. Moses took one part of the blood and put it in basins, and the other part of the blood he dashed against the altar. Verse 7. Then he took the record of the covenant and read it aloud to the people. As noted in the commentary to verse 3, what Moses likely read aloud to the people were the laws following the Ten Commandments in chapters 21 through 23, laws overwhelmingly social and ethical in nature. The only religious laws included in these chapters are the commandments to observe the Sabbath and the festivals, and the prohibition against worshiping false gods. Essay: Doing and Understanding God's Will. Verse 7 continued, "And they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will faithfully do." The English translation here, "all that the Lord has spoken, we will faithfully do," is not literal. The Hebrew literally says, "all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will hear," or listen. The order of the verbs is significant because they are obviously counterintuitive. One has to hear what one is supposed to do before promising to do it, yet the order here is reversed. First we will do, and then we will hear. Because the order of the words seems to make no sense, almost all translations render the verb hear to mean obey. Thus the oldest and still great English translation, the King James Version, reads, "All that the Lord hath said will we do, and be obedient." Similarly, the highly praised modern translation, the New International Version, NIV, reads, "We will do everything the Lord has said, we will obey." But logic suggests those translations, while literally accurate, are not what the statement intends to convey. Obey is not the correct translation of the word hear, because the statement would then be essentially redundant. There is no real difference between "we will do" and "we will obey." For that reason, it would seem in this context and similar contexts in our own lives, hear means understand. When we tell someone, "I hear you," we are usually not saying our ears are registering their words. We are saying we understand what the person has said. For example, when a parent says to a child, "Did you hear what I said?" they are asking, "Did you understand what I said?" Therefore, the verse really means we will do and we will understand. This is a major life lesson. Doing leads to understanding. When we act lovingly, we understand love. When we see an apple fall from a tree, we understand gravity. We understand marriage only after being married. Only when we experience cold can we understand cold. A year of explaining cold is nothing compared to a few seconds of experiencing it. And this applies to understanding the divine. In the words of the psalmist, "Taste and see how good the Lord is," Psalms 34, verse 9. The Israelites have already affirmed they will do the commandments, verse 3. Now they affirm they will then understand. Understanding after doing is true of all the commandments, but it is especially true of the ritual commandments, those that relate to the relationship between man and God. For example, no amount of explanation of the benefits of observing the Shabbat can compete with living it. But that is not all the Israelites are saying here. They are committing themselves to understanding the commandments, not just to doing them. This needs to be emphasized, because for many religious people, too much of their religious life is habit, not understanding. Therefore, one who commits to doing God's commandments also has to commit to attempting to understand those commandments. Habit and or blind faith is not sufficient when it comes to ritual laws. When it comes to ethical laws, however, observance out of habit or even from blind faith is acceptable, though not the ideal. One would hope there is an internal ethical transformation when one commits to leading an ethical life. If you don't steal simply because God said so, the benefits are still enormous both to you and to society. But if you observe religious rituals out of habit with no understanding, they can become meaningless. In other words, ethical behavior is an end in itself. Ritual behavior is a means to an end. Those ends are holiness, God, and the elevation of the self to a higher plane. Verse 8. Moses took the blood and dashed it on the people and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord now makes with you concerning all these commands." Blood was used in making a covenant because blood was understood to be the essence of animal and human life. Verse 9. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and 70 elders of Israel ascended. The narrative turns to the response to God's commandment at the beginning of the chapter to ascend the mountain. Verse 10. And they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet there was the likeness of a pavement of sapphire, like the very sky, for purity. This is to be understood, according to Moses, as a description of a sight so uniquely glorious, it seemed they were seeing the divine, but not God. Later in Deuteronomy, chapter 4, verse 12, Moses specifically says about this very moment, "Then the Lord spoke to you out of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but saw no form." Likewise, God says, "No one may see me and live." Exodus, chapter 33, verse 20. The words, "and they saw the God of Israel," are therefore akin to our saying, "When I see a beautiful sunset or a child born, I see God." Verse 11. Yet he did not raise his hand against the leaders of the Israelites. They beheld God, and they ate and drank. The Torah mentions the leaders of Israel ate and drank to show they survived the experience of beholding God. The point is they survived precisely because they did not literally see God. Thus, the words translated here as "they beheld God" can be better rendered as "they had a vision of God." Verse 12. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the teachings and commandments, which I have inscribed to instruct them." Verse 13. So Moses and his attendant Joshua arose, and Moses ascended the mountain of God. Verse 14. To the elders he had said, "Wait here for us until we return to you. You have Aaron and Nur with you. Let anyone who has a legal matter approach them." Even during an intensely religious period, legal matters and disputes will arise and must be addressed. Verse 15. When Moses had ascended the mountain, the cloud covered the mountain. Verse 16. The presence of the Lord abode on Mount Sinai, and the cloud hid it for 6 days. On the seventh day he called Moses from the midst of the cloud. Verse 17. Now the presence of the Lord appeared in the sight of the Israelites as a consuming fire on the top of the mountain. Verse 18. Moses went inside the cloud and ascended the mountain, and Moses remained on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. This verse serves as a preamble to the story of the golden calf, chapter 32, which the people will build when they despair at losing their leader for 40 days. Chapter 25. Verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, The remainder of the book of Exodus is largely about the building of the tabernacle, the portable sanctuary used by the Israelites in the desert. More chapters are devoted to the tabernacle and the details of its construction and functioning than to any other subject in the 5 books of the Torah, Exodus chapters 25 through 31 and chapters 35 through 40. Nearly all the material in these chapters is repeated in the final chapters of Exodus. These chapters describe God's instructions to Moses about how to construct the tabernacle. The later chapters describe the tabernacle's actual construction. According to Everett Fox, the great amount of attention devoted to the building of the tabernacle throughout the second half of Exodus is an indication of the tabernacle's centrality to Israelite worship. It was the center of grain and animal sacrifice, which was the chief means of religious expression in antiquity. The Israelites are to engage in making the tabernacle in the same way God engaged in making the world. In imitation of God, the Israelites are to stop their work on the seventh day. This likely is the reason the laws of the Sabbath are reiterated immediately following the detailed blueprint of the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 through 17. Why the unparalleled amount of detail here? One reason for the extraordinarily detailed instructions listed here is the most obvious one, because the Torah records what God says. But of course the question remains, why did God go into such detail? The most persuasive reason I have heard was offered by Rabbi Saul Berman. By listing every material required and how much was required, there would be no opportunity for those tasked with collecting the gifts to solicit more than was required and pocket the difference. There is a great virtue in openness, particularly in public financial matters. Individuals and especially governments have been notorious for corruption in building projects by, for example, paying or receiving kickbacks, bribes officials take from contractors in exchange for hiring them over others who may have submitted lower bids. By listing the precise specifications for the tabernacle in a document accessible to every person, the officials couldn't later claim more material was required than was recorded. One other reason was to communicate the important role aesthetic beauty can play in the worship of God. Essay. In religious ritual, unlike in ethical behavior, intentions matter. Verse 2. Tell the Israelite people to bring me gifts. You shall accept gifts for me from every person whose heart so moves him. Ordinarily, the Torah gives commandments we must fulfill regardless of whether our heart is in fulfilling them or not. Moral actions must be taken, whether or not our heart prompts us to. Accordingly, the Torah commands that every third year we give 10% of our earnings to the poor, Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 12, and an additional percentage each year, Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 through 10, irrespective of whether our hearts prompt us to do so. But with regard to giving to God, our hearts can determine how much we give. Charity is given to people. Therefore, it is a moral, ethical act. And regarding the ethical, God does not demand the heart. Good actions, actions that help other human beings, are worthwhile in and of themselves, because recipients of charity are helped regardless of our intentions. Or to put it another way, good actions are good, even if animated by selfishness. And bad actions are bad, even if animated by good intentions. If a person builds a hospital because he wants to become famous by having the hospital named for him, that hospital saves just as many lives as hospitals built by people animated solely by altruistic motives. Furthermore, people whose lives are saved by a hospital built by a person who wanted to be famous are just as grateful as those whose lives are saved by hospitals built by selfless people. In ethics, what matters most is results, not intentions. At the same time, good intentions leading to bad results are worthless. Such is the case, for example, when wealthy nations, for altruistic reasons, give large sums of money to poor countries whose corrupt governments are then strengthened. Such aid does more harm than good. This is also true within wealthier nations. Society must, of course, take care of those who are in real need. But a certain percentage of people who are capable of working and providing for themselves will choose not to work, and instead seek to be financially supported by the government. This in turn leads to three awful consequences. One, it erodes the character of those relying on such aid. Two, it reduces the amount of resources available to care for the truly needy. Three, it literally makes addicts out of many of these people. They become addicted to receiving unearned income. It can be as difficult to wean people off unearned benefits as it is to wean people off drugs. Each of these destructive consequences is the product of good intentions. The history of the modern world is filled with people who have done terrible things from sincere and good motives. The large number of individuals in democracies who supported communist tyrannies is one obvious example. In other words, regarding morality, intentions matter little and often not at all. But when it comes to relating to God, prayer, ritual acts, etc., intentions matter a great deal. The Israelites' gifts will be used to build a place to worship God. This, then, is a ritual act. And when it comes to ritual, our hearts need to be involved if the act is to have significance. Unlike moral actions, which are ends in themselves, a ritual is not an end in itself, but a means of bringing the individual closer to God and to greater holiness. Because all the donations given by the Israelites to building the tabernacle were voluntary, we come across no grumbling, even though until now the Israelites have repeatedly expressed angry complaints against both God and Moses. That indicates the wisdom of soliciting voluntary contributions in the ritual realm. Many hundreds of years later, when the Israelites were firmly ensconced in their homeland, King Solomon set out to build the sequel to the tabernacle, the Beit HaMikdash, the Great Temple in Jerusalem. Solomon, however, chose not to rely on voluntary contributions and imposed forced labor. 10,000 men were sent each month to work in timber-rich Lebanon, while 70,000 porters and 80,000 stonecutters were assigned to labor in Israel. Some 3,300 officials were appointed to oversee the temple's erection. 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 27 through 30. Essay. Beauty can bring people closer to God. Verse 3. And these are the gifts that you shall accept from them, gold, silver, and copper. The Torah now details the gifts the Israelites may bring, but not until verse 8 do we learn what they are for. The list that follows includes all the Israelites' most valuable possessions. Although most of these recently liberated slaves owned only a few precious items, they were willing to part with them. Presumably, they were willing to do so because they wanted to feel connected to God. Many moderns strongly criticize religions for building ornate temples, churches, and cathedrals. All that wealth would be much better used to help the poor, they argue. The most often cited examples are Catholic cathedrals built in the midst of poverty. I don't find this a valid criticism. For one thing, the construction and furnishing of those cathedrals employed many thousands of people over the course of decades and even centuries. It took about 250 years to build the York Cathedral in England, for example. But most important, if all the gold in every cathedral in the poorest Catholic countries were melted, and everything of value in those cathedrals were sold off, with the money then dispersed among its neediest citizens, it would have minimal immediate and no enduring impact on poverty. A small percentage of the many millions of poor people would benefit, and only for a very limited period. Then they would be left with no more cathedral in their midst. For most of these people, their greatest source of communal pride, and a place that brought them closer to God and uplifted their spirits. These cathedrals have given untold numbers of poor and wealthy people peace, meaning, and solace, things for which secular Westerners have little appreciation or empathy. Like the Israelites in the desert, most of these poor people have preferred to establish an enduring connection to God through their gifts, than have a little bit of extra gold for a few days or weeks. The late British rabbi Hugo Grin recounted a story from when he was a teenage prisoner in the Nazi concentration camp of Auschwitz. One midwinter evening, one of the inmates reminded us that tonight was the first night of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights. My father constructed a little Hanukkah menorah out of scrap metal. For a wick, he took some threads from his prison uniform. For oil, he used some butter that he somehow procured from a guard. Although such observances were strictly verboten, forbidden, we were used to taking risks. But I protested at the waste of precious calories. Would it not be better to share butter on a crust of bread than to burn it? Hugo, said my father, both you and I know that a person can live a very long time without food. But Hugo, I tell you, a person cannot live a single day without hope. Without God, there is no hope. Only God gives us hope there is something beyond this life, a destination where ultimate justice is achieved, where we reconnect with loved ones, and where life doesn't abruptly end for all eternity. A beautiful religious ritual or a beautiful religious edifice can bring us closer to God and hope. In my lifetime, unlike in some previous generations, most Jews have, for whatever reason, chosen not to build particularly beautiful synagogues, and for the most part, Christians are no longer building beautiful churches, much less cathedrals. But Jews who find inspiration and meaning in religious ritual often spend a good deal of money on religious objects, such as a Hanukkah menorah, a citron for Sukkot, the holiday of tabernacles, when Jews say a blessing while holding a palm frond and a citron, a citron box, and a Havdalah set for the ceremony separating the Sabbath and other holidays from the rest of the week. Beautiful rituals, beautiful places of worship, beautiful art, and music that elevates us and brings us closer to God are worth more than material benefits. Verse 3 continued, "And these are the gifts that you shall accept from them." The Torah now lists 7 categories of materials with which to make the tabernacle: metals, dyed yarns, fabrics, timber, oil, spices, gems. The number 7 recurs throughout the description of the blueprint for the tabernacle, and as the number 7, repeated over and over in the Torah, always does, recalls God's creation of the world in 7 days. Our creative labor in building the tabernacle is thereby linked to the Creator. Verse 3 continued, "Gold, silver, and copper." In the tabernacle, these materials are encountered in the opposite order. The entrance area is copper, the next chamber is silver, and the Holy of Holies, the innermost chamber where God's Spirit dwells, is gold. The closer the object is to the Holy of Holies, the more valuable the metal of which it is made, sarna. Iron is not mentioned because it was used as a weapon of war, and therefore had no place in God's sanctuary. The Talmud explains, "For iron used in making weapons was created to shorten man's days, while the altar was created to lengthen man's days. And it does not seem right that that which shortens life should be wielded against that which prolongs it." Verse 4. Blue, purple, and crimson yarns, fine linen, goat's hair. Each of these colors has symbolic significance. Blue represents the heavens and the creation of the world. Purple represents royalty. The high cost of purple dye due to its rare source generally meant only the wealthiest individuals, usually royalty, owned purple garments. And crimson represents sin, as reflected in Isaiah's statement, "Be your sins like crimson, they can turn snow white." That is, if you repent, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. These colors represent the major themes Israelites were supposed to think about during worship: God's creation, God's kingship, and God's acceptance of atonement for sin. Verse 5, tanned ram skins, dolphin skins, and acacia wood. Verse 6, oil for lighting, spices for the anointing oil and for the aromatic incense. Verse 7, lapis lazuli and other stones for setting, for the ephod and for the breastpiece. The ephod was a vest worn by the high priest when he presided at the altar. See Exodus chapter 28, verses 4 through 12, and chapter 39, verses 2 through 7. 2 onyx stones upon which were engraved the names of the 12 tribes of Israel were placed on the shoulder of the ephod. Where is God? Verse 8. And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. We would expect this verse to read, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in it." Instead, this verse states God will dwell among them. God wants the Israelites to know that while he is invisible, he is not remote. He dwells in their midst wherever they are. The portability of the tabernacle is a reminder God is not restricted to any specific location, another revolutionary innovation of the Torah. Everett Fox comments that the tabernacle is God's resoundingly positive answer to the question asked by the Israelites shortly after leaving Egypt: is the Lord present among us or not? Exodus chapter 17, verse 7. The 19th century rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk challenged his followers one day with the question, "Where does God exist?" Puzzled by what sounded almost heretical, they answered, "God exists everywhere." "No," the rabbi responded, "God exists wherever man lets him in." God's statement that he will dwell among the people emphasizes the tabernacle is not for him, but for God. God can be found everywhere, but there are certain settings in which it is easier for us to encounter him. The tabernacle is intended to serve as one such setting. Today, we each must seek out a place or places in which we are able to feel close to God, whether it is a synagogue sanctuary, a cathedral, or an open field, though this risks people confusing God with nature. God can be experienced through nature, but God is not in nature, he is above it. It is his handiwork. But the rabbi's response was the best of all. God is wherever we let him in, meaning God is most present whenever we are good and just to other human beings. Nothing inspires people to believe in God as much as God-centered people doing good, just as nothing alienates people from belief in God as much as people doing evil in God's name. Essay. Without standards, everything good will fail. Verse 9. Exactly as I show you, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, so shall you make it. This is one of those verses in the Torah that does not seem particularly significant, but is actually one of the most significant. To understand why, let's pose a question. Why doesn't God stop speaking after verse 8? Why doesn't he simply give an instruction? Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, and stop there. Wouldn't there be great Israelite artists, designers, and architects who could have designed and built something beautiful? Perhaps they could have, but there would have been two possible problems. First, leaving it completely up to the subjective tastes of some Israelites might well have led to the building of a tabernacle that would be uninspiring, or worse, looked just like a pagan house of worship. Or it could have led to building something simply ugly. As much guideline-free and God-free architecture and art produced in the 20th and 21st centuries do. See the discussion concerning art in the commandment against worshiping false gods, Exodus chapter 20, verse 3. Second, as noted above, the Israelite elite could have kept some of the precious jewels they requisitioned for the tabernacle for themselves. The highest achievement of art is to elevate man. But that, of course, presumes there is something higher than man to elevate him to. And if that is true of art, it is particularly true regarding the place where people go to experience God. Therefore, God gives the instructions. The design of the tabernacle is not left to men, no matter how artistically talented they may be. Of course, God can't give every artist in every generation instructions on how to build places of worship, let alone how to make art or compose music. But there is nevertheless an important lesson here about art and religion. Both need standards, or they become useless and even destructive. For more on this topic, see the commentary to Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, the prohibition on worshiping false gods. Regarding religion, the Torah provides guidelines on how to lead a religious life. While there is room for spontaneity in religion, prayer being an obvious example, such spontaneity must be within the context of the Torah's ethical monotheism. In our time, many people believe they need no guidance on how to express religiosity, or as many put it, spirituality. They attempt to be religious without adhering to any religious standards, or even just to biblical ethical monotheism. While it is certainly possible to be a Torah-based ethical monotheist without identifying with any religion, there is nevertheless much truth to what the 20th century American philosopher George Santayana said. To attempt to be religious without practicing a specific religion is like trying to speak without speaking a specific language. Without the Torah, we would not know how to become God-centered. Without the Torah, we would not even know what God means. In the Canaanite society surrounding the Israelites, people thought gods wanted children sacrificed to them. And the Egyptians thought their gods wanted elaborate tombs constructed by slave labor. The great lesson of this verse is individuals and societies need ethical, moral, artistic, and religious standards that transcend them, or there will be no more ethics, morality, art, or good religion. Verse 10. They shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. The Torah here lists the items to be built and placed in the tabernacle. These items are listed in order from the most holy to the least holy, starting with the ark. The ark is the holiest object because it contains the Ten Commandments, which is the centerpiece of the tabernacle. To this day, the holiest object in every synagogue is the ark, the Aron Kodesh, which contains Torah scrolls. And in many synagogues, the Ten Commandments are listed on the front of the ark. A cubit is a standard biblical measurement. In ancient times, it was generally thought to be the distance between the tip of the middle finger and the elbow of a person of average height, The Hebrew word for cubit, amah, also means forearm. It is assumed to be about 18 to 21 inches, 45 to 53 centimeters. Verse 11. Overlay it with pure gold. Overlay it inside and out.